This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the Positive Populist Podcast. It's our inaugural podcast, and I'm so excited that Sebastian Thrun is with me today. Sebastian is a friend of mine. We live very close to each other in Silicon Valley. He really belongs in Silicon Valley, unlike me. Sebastian is an incredible computer scientist, one of the inventors of self-driving cars, now working on flying cars, the founder of a company called Udacity, which is an incredibly interesting company, helping people to acquire skills for the jobs of the future. There's such a long list. I don't know where to start. Oh, Stanford University, artificial intelligence. You had this incredible course, didn't you, at Stanford University, which was really the pioneer of the whole movement we've seen for what's called massive online open courses, which is people being able to learn at a distance. Incredible, incredible accomplishments. So, Sebastian, welcome. And I want to start with this question. Are you or could you ever be a positive populist?
First of all, Steve, it's so great seeing you. And as you rattle down some of the things I've done, I feel really, really old right now. I'm just generally positive by nature because I think, I mean, there's challenges in the world. There's challenges that I face and we face that require a lot of careful thinking. But in the grand course of things, things tend to work out in a positive way, and there's progress tends to make the world a better place. So I go around the world and tell people stop being so depressed, like stop thinking we are all getting poorer, or we are all getting sicker, or we all work harder, or the world is getting into extreme poverty by the day. These are all just myths. These are just negative things that people have, and we should just eradicate those.
Great. Well, that's a very, if anyone can eradicate things in a scalable way, I think that's a term that you hear a lot in Silicon Valley. That is you. I want to start by just asking you then to tell us really the story of how you got to Silicon Valley. As people can hear from your accent, I think that you're not a native Californian like me. Where did you come from, Sebastian? How did you get here?
Born and raised in Germany, 1967. Regular white, blue collar parents, and then got my degrees.
Whereabouts in Germany? Paint us the picture. What kind of?
It's just close to Berlin, in a small city called Hildesheim, 100,000 souls, everybody, and basically, and a part of Germany where the most pedantic of all Germans live. They have absolutely no sense of humor.
Pedantic Germans. That's like really something.
Yes. Okay. Everything is serious always.
Okay.
In fact, it's Germans where the first question often is, what's the negative?
Oh, interesting.
We are really, really good in finding this one negative thing in your life. Like, oh my God. So I went to my sister the other day and she hadn't seen me in 5 years. And the very first thing she said is, wow, you've gotten really fat.
Oh my God.
And he was very correct. This is not the way we do it in America.
Absolutely not. God, that's amazing. Especially California.
Yes.
I just want to get a sense of you. Back there in Germany, I mean, obviously you're so associated now with science and technology. And was that always the case? Was that your passion when you were a kid, or did it suddenly come along later?
I was the third in the bunch, and my parents didn't have quite the attention past two of them. So I was always put in the corner. And I learned from this to kind of get along with myself. So I built lots of stuff and so on, and read lots of books.
But what kind
of,
you mean, I don't know, Legos or what?
Yeah, there was a version of Lego in Germany. No one knows, but like an Erector set type thing that I spent like years doing stuff, way too many.
Okay.
And then I guess I found computers, and computers at the time were not very, very popular. So a department store had these computers sitting there and for sale, and I would go there after school for 3 or 4 hours and program something and come back the next day and program some more. And the staff realized I was actually stealing their resources, but they liked me. There's this kid coming in every day playing on this thing called computer, but not buying it.
Right.
And that's how I learned how to program computers.
How old were you roughly when you're doing that?
12 years old.
So you learned it, you taught yourself to program computers.
Yeah. And the machine was worth $400. It had no memory, so you couldn't save the work of the day. So every time programmer came in, I had to reprogram what I programmed yesterday, uh-huh. and then on top of it, the new thing. So it became very efficient in moving my fingers.
So I just want to do a sort of quick detour from the story there, because I'm just really interested in, with all your knowledge now about artificial intelligence, how the brain works, how computers work, that you know, the connection between the two of them. Would you say that this was a question back then for you of just natural aptitude, or could any kid have done it if they went frequently enough? What was there something about your brain that from an early age lent itself to this kind of thing?
It's kind of hard to say, because I never ran the experiment to build 1,000 Sebastians and do the statistics. And it's introspective. But I would say in childhood education right now, I would say there's three things that should really matter, right? Mm-hmm. One is social-emotional skills. One is technical skills. And one is what I call perseverance. Like, if you start something, get it done. And I think we do really, really good job in this country with the technical skills, your mm-hmm. English language skills, comprehension skills, and math skills. We do a lousy job with mm-hmm. social emotional skills, and we do a lousy job with perseverance. Mm-hmm. So for me, I still am weak on the social emotional side, but I learn how to persevere. So I can really focus on something to the point that I forget to eat.
And did someone teach you that? Are you saying that was that innate?
That was the result of me being pretty much left alone as the third kid. So I had two siblings who I left on the door, who were very demanding in their time. Uh-huh. And I was just tucked in the corner. That was my life.
So you just had to get on with it.
Yeah, and it was great. I loved it.
Interesting. Okay, great. So then what were the steps that – let's just talk us through how you got here. You're developing this aptitude for computers. You doing your programming –
So I grew up in a family with lots of rules and Catholic family and so on. And in the early age, I just felt my sport in life has to be to break all the rules. So in grade 7, I decided, uh-huh. as a sport, can I make it through middle school and then high school without ever doing homework assignment? And I was like, sport. I was like, I had specific rules. I was able to copy from other people, but only under those circumstances. Right. I wasn't able to put anything original on my end, but mm-hmm. copying and stealing was okay. Right. And as a result, I had to make myself liked. The other people would give me the homework assignment, so I had to be nice to people. I learned how to be nice because for this challenge. Wow. And as I then transitioned into college, I still remember this. Every time professor said, do something this way, I immediately tried the opposite way. Every single time.
I love that, Sebastian. I understand why we're friends. That is totally my instinct for everything. Yes. And I'm still getting nearly arrested all the time, you know, for sort of asking why I have to do this or tell me, you know. Like,
I mean, it's not a good heuristic in life. I mean, most of the time you screw up if you do this. Right. But occasionally it's something great. So, for example, at age 21-ish, I'm now an undergrad student. There's this incredibly important scientific conference where the professors uh-huh. might go to if they're really, really lucky. And I decide I'm going to submit a contribution, a paper. The way this works is these scientific conferences, the world's best people meet, in this case in Denver, Colorado, and to get in there, you have to submit a scientific hypothesis, a contribution, a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. So I did this, and it got in. It was a 2% acceptance rate. The conference is now called NURIPS or NIPS. And all of a sudden, I went to America, standing in front of the world's best expert as a 22-year-old now,
right,
and trying to defend my pretty crappy paper.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
But everyone around me in Germany said it can't be done. Everyone said, no, don't do it. Uh-huh. You're too young. You're not senior enough. You're not a professor yet. You're just an undergrad student. So it was something where people told me you can't do it, made me want to do it.
Great. Well, that's great. And then you stay here, basically, do you, after that, in America?
Yeah, so I got my various degrees up to PhD in Germany. And then I found this incredibly great job at Carnegie Mellon University in mm-hmm. Pittsburgh, which mm-hmm. I love Pittsburgh, where I got a chance to basically meet the world's best people in computer science. Mm-hmm. And now my community weren't the naysayers of my childhood. They were the yes-sayers in the world. They were like these incredibly inspiring professors that I would literally go every day into the building thinking, they made a mistake, they're going to find out, they're going to come to me and say, thank you so much, Sebastian, and sent me back on a plane.
And so those professors, right, were they all from all over the world?
Yes, absolutely. And I loved it because I would have dinner with a person from China or lunch with a person from India. And in doing so, I realized, my God, there is so many fewer rules than there should be. Mm-hmm. The other way around, sorry. There's so many more rules in Germany than there should be. Mm-hmm. Because in Germany, you dress a certain way, you behave a certain mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. In India, you dress differently mm-hmm. and you behave differently. But that's still fine, still humans.
But what I'm driving at then is that, what is it, the culture of that Carnegie Mellon? Is it the culture of American academia? Is it the culture of America? Or is it the individual culture of the people with that attitude gravitate towards a place like that? What's going on that it's so different from what you've
I mean, I can tell you as a kind of rule breaker, and I mean this hopefully in a positive way. Mm-hmm. I would, of course, find myself in environments where I find other people who are visionary, who want to change the world, and who are not willing to accept the history as the lone guidepost for what is possible in the future. I mean, we live in a world where technology is transforming every aspect of human life. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, we should question every aspect of human life, not destroy it, but at least question it and have a debate. It's like politics done the right way? Is education done the right way? Is transportation done the right way? And very often when we think first principles, we come up with different solutions.
So let's jump to one of those things. Like, and there's many that you have worked on, are working on, that you would definitely put in that category of world-changing things. Let's take one of the ones you're most famously identified with, self-driving cars. What's the story there? Where did that start? How did you...
Well, it started out in around 2004-ish. I was now a professor at Stanford, mm-hmm. and teaching robotics, artificial intelligence. And this challenge came along that the U.S. government created. It was called DARPA Grand Challenge. Mm-hmm. And it was a challenge to universities and companies and individuals to build the very first self-driving car, so to speak. The car had to drive itself about 130 miles mm-hmm. through the Mojave Desert without a driver inside. And it was kind of not as complex as today because there were no other cars. Right. It was basically a very stationary environment. But it was tough. 196 teams competed. Uh-huh. And my tiny team in Stanford won. It was a kind of a watershed moment for me.
But that is an amazing thing, right?
I mean, it changed my career.
I want to hear a bit more about it. I mean, how long did it... You know, what's the sort of trajectory, the timeline, I guess, from you hearing about the contest, putting a team together? What happened? What's
so
the story?
I got involved just about a year before the actual event, and I had nothing. I had no students, I had no car, no computers, no money. So I decided as a Stanford professor to teach a class on this topic. And mm-hmm. my Stanford students that are there, of course, for college credit, would secretly work for me for free building my first round of technology. So I made this class and I told the students, it's actually a great phenomenon. At Stanford, you can go and tell the student, let's do one quarter and slow climate change. Mm-hmm. And the students don't quite know how hard it is, so they're just going to try it. Okay.
Right.
So in this case, I said, let's do one quarter, it's like 10 weeks, and build a self-driving car that can drive at least a mile through the Mojave Desert.
Wow.
And lo and behold, 10 weeks later, we had a car, it was instrumented, programmed, had a machine learning and all this wonderful stuff, and it was driving 8.4 miles.
How many students?
It started with 40 students.
Right.
In week two, only 20 students came back because the other 20 were smart enough to realize it would wreck their other studies working with me.
Because it's so intense.
And then they got consumed by it. There was no sleep anymore. It was intense.
That's just an amazing story. And in 10 weeks, you did it 8 times what the plan was.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
it's... And just so I just want to understand, like, the motivation for the original... The contest, you know, the DARPA, the part of the Defense Department, right?
That's correct. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so that notion of a self-drive, they call it autonomous vehicle. What do they call? I don't know, like that, whatever language they had. Was that something that had been around for a long time, that was a sort of fantasy, and then that they now thought the technology is good enough that we might make this a reality?
I think this is one of these star moments of American history, almost, I'd say, mm-hmm. ingenuity. The U.S. government had spent roughly $500 million of money in research funds on self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. And what they typically got is a vehicle that could drive a quarter of a mile and then crash frontally into a tree,
right.
combined with a stack of research papers, which basically said, give us more money. I would say, despite some good work in the field, this was a far cry from anything interesting. And the U.S. government really came up with this idea to say, normally we pay people for work. We give them money for every hour worked. Mm-hmm. Let's do something else. Let's give people money for accomplishment, for doing something that has an outcome. So they put out this $1 million price and later raised it to $2 million to say, if anyone can do this, you're going to make $2 million.
Wow. Amazing. And so then let's just, like, you won the prize. What then? I mean, like, you're now, that's an incredible feat.
Yeah, so I got bitten by this bug to say, let's just find and change the world. And I have a really embarrassing story. So I did Street View and a few other things at Google.
Well, but how did you get to Google? You're not at Google at this point.
Yeah, so my next step in life is to start a startup company. And the reason is all my colleague professors do startup companies, right, and they have fun, and some of them have bigger cars as a result. So I decide I'm going to start a company. And eventually we converge for a small version of what later becomes Street View. And we have a
Google Street View. Right.
Google Street View. And we have a small inside Stanford version that we build up, mm-hmm, where you can record images of all of San Francisco, and then you can use your phone and kind of re-experience the feeling of driving to San Francisco the way we see Street View today.
Right.
And that's when Larry came by, Larry Page, the Google co-founder,
yeah,
and kind of convinced us to continue this work at Google, with the argument that at Google we have a much bigger compute farm, we had much more money, we can, right, buy many more cars, many
so
more people.
So he basically wandering around Stanford looking for great, yeah, ideas and people. Yeah. Right, and you were on his radar, as it were.
Yeah.
He says, come to Google, then you did.
Yeah, it was really fun. It was really amazing. And for me it was amazing because I was kind of now a somewhat, like, I hate to say this, but famous Stanford professor. I won the Starbucks One Challenge. And Google made me what's called an engineering manager too. So Google, right, has about 11 or 12 or 13 steps of hierarchy. And it wasn't the fifth lowest step. So I was basically the lowest kid on the block. Right. So now I had to learn how to survive a company. And that was a lot of fun.
Do you mean in terms of the bureaucracy that you suddenly experienced? What were the challenges?
Look, in every big human organization, there's this pain in organizing things.
Yeah.
There's people who have to say yes. There are people that don't like it that much if you make progress, but they don't. So I had to really navigate this fairly monstrous mapping organization, which at the time had more than 500 staff members, to
at
really
Google.
Get something done. At Google, yeah.
Mapping. So what were they up to? What was the...
Mapping, this Google Maps, the product was amazing. Google Maps is, I think, by far the best mapping application in the world. It did direction giving and so on. We actually even incorporated the Street View. But it's a very different skill. As a professor, you're like this demigod, right? Mm-hmm. You say something and people think you said something really, really smart. Like, right. Even if you didn't even say it, they ascribe it to you.
Yeah.
If you're in an organization as the middle of a manager, you have a manager above you and that manager might not agree.
And so talk to me about the mapping, because we've had a conversation before, and I think about this, and I think people will be staggered to sort of understand the thought process within Google that kind of led to the building of Google Maps as a product, and the literally the mapping of the world and how that happened. Just tell us about that.
Yeah, so the idea of building a digital map of the world way predates me, and I think the Google founders founded the company with this desire, not just to with the textual information, like the web information and the video, but also the geographic information available to the world. And they had this vision from almost day one that at some point you had a mobile device, later on called a smartphone, where you could, mm-hmm, really go and put in your directions and it helps you navigate. I joined this specifically for Street View, and the vision here was that if you could just go and look at places, look how people live, and understand how people live, we would bring the people in the world closer together. Mm-hmm. So we did something crazy. We, on day one, I remember, we went to a store and bought 100 cars.
Right.
And the dealer was falling over. Like, my God, 100 cars a day. This is cool. And then we bought 100 cameras. And we then hired 100 drivers, initially from Craigslist, actually, and then later on to a staffing company. They would just send out and say, hey, drive as much as you can. And we would reward them for every mile that they drive that had previously not been mapped.
Right.
So some of the drivers are really nice and they would drive down to San Francisco, but the really smart ones realize is you can't map that many miles in stop and go traffic in a big city. So we had the very first version of Street, we had massive number of cornfields mapped in Iowa, because, right, if you map the cornfields in Iowa, you can map many more unique miles than you can do in a big city.
That's amazing. So you literally have, this is what I think people would find amazing, is that, and we hear all the time about, you know, artificial intelligence, we've talked about that, and robots and technology. In the end, this was people driving cars,
yeah, it's
taking
amazing
pictures with a camera.
And look, the people would collect roughly like a terabyte of data per day, and that's actually was a fairly big disk in the day. So after like 3 weeks, they had a big pack and box full of disks. And the only way to bring the data back to Google was by FedEx. So we then had 100 drivers FedExing us every 20 days a huge box of 20 disks, mm-hmm, which meant that all of a sudden we had this massive stack of thousands of disks sitting in Oregon in a data center, and we didn't know how to get them in. So we hired people that whose sole job it was to pick up a disk, plug in the computer, wait a few hours until the data is copied, and take it out. It was a gigantic. This was the biggest image database that ever existed.
Yeah. And what I love about that story and is the way you're talking about it is that, especially now when Google is seen as this sort of giant, you know, entity, and you know, some people have very negative views about it for that exact reason and so on. But and this has got this assumed all-knowing ability and all-powerful. But actually, a lot of this is just improvisation, isn't it? Sort of making it up. What do we do here? How do we get that happen? It's really interesting how that growth happened.
I mean, I would say this is something I've learned, and I would love to share with everybody, is like from the outside, it always looks like Silicon Valley has a clear roadmap, and we don't. Every time you innovate, every time you do something new, you will fail and fail. Not even fail. Your first guess won't work, and mm-hmm. you have to learn from it and improve yourself. If you don't have this kind of open, curious mindset and the willingness to learn, the willingness to concede defeat and change your direction, you'll never, never, ever succeed. So what we do is we pick these visions. Like the vision was, why can't we like visualize every road from street level?
Right.
And that's a gigantic vision. And you could easily prove it can't be done, except we did it.
And what's the mindset that really enables that? Is it the kind of, well, you've got to start somewhere, so let's just put one foot in front of the other, rather than just seeing the whole thing? Or
I mean, people ask me about it, I would say, We are simultaneously really, really arrogant and really, really humble. We're arrogant when we proclaim we can do this. For example, saying we're going to build a self-driving car at the time we said it was incredibly arrogant mm-hmm. because the technology wasn't there at all. And then we are humble in that when we then go and climb this mountain that we want to climb, that we're completely willing to go step after step, as you said, Steve. And then if we reach a false summit, we're willing to turn around. Mm-hmm. If there is a bad weather coming in, we can't see the summit, we still believe it's there. So you have to put these two things together.
So I want to flip to another company that you started, Udacity. I want to hear the story of that, because I think there's a connection there with where we started, that whole conversation about populism and being positive about technology and how it can help people. Because one of the biggest things that people are worried about is the fact that technology could really destroy jobs and people's livelihoods on an epic scale. And I think Udacity's got a really interesting part to play in that story.
Yeah, I mean, Udacity, for the readers here or listeners here, is kind of like an online university that teaches tech skills. Like, you want to become a software engineer, machine learning expert, data scientist, you come to us, you pay typically like $1,000 or so, and in many, many cases, you can find a job in that area, often making tens of thousands of dollars extra. The way it started, however, was very different. Mm-hmm. The way it started is I was working at Google, and we decided completely randomly that I would take a Stanford class online. Mm-hmm. It was 2011. I was teaching at Stanford in my free time, a Stanford graduate level AI class, artificial intelligence class, and we decided to make it available online for free. And we expected at the time, it wasn't a very hot topic like today, we expected only 500, maybe 1,000 students to sign up, but 160,000 students signed up. So I was teaching a class to 160,000 students. Just imagine as a professor what that means to your life. I could go to any airport in the world and people would come up to me and say, "Hi, professor." That's crazy.
Wow.
And then of the 160,000, 23,000 actually finished. And I had the same class on campus, same homework assignment, same final exam. So I could compare my 200 Stanford students to those 23,000 finishers. And it turned out the top 412 people, students, in terms of stack ranking, were not at Stanford. The best Stanford student ranked number 413.
Wow. Sorry, but that's an amazing. I mean, I didn't realize that aspect of it.
There was another aspect.
So the best students, the 400s, were not even there. They were just purely online.
Yeah, there were people you would never think of as a great student by their history or by their CV. So along the way,
what did you mean by that?
Yeah, I tell you. Along the way, 40,000 people fell behind in the homework assignment. So I sent 40,000 emails, and I got 40,000 my dog ate my homework kind of emails back.
Yeah,
and I started leading those and writing these stories. There was a lady named Diane, who was a mother, just recently divorced, one child teething. She was sick, her family members lost a job, and she wanted to take this class and ace it in the end to prove to herself she's worthy of anything. It was amazing. There was a soldier in Afghanistan fighting for us, exfiltrating war zones in the middle of the night to reach a computer terminal in time to submit their homework in time.
No.
There was a lady...
To your artificial intelligence?
Yes.
He's on active duty now.
Active duty in Afghanistan.
Oh, my gosh.
And he's already working on the future past active duty.
I'm sorry, that's just... I'd never heard that.
There's a lady named Melody, whom I had the great pleasure of meeting later, who is a lady in Santa Cruz, is an IT professional, and she was on dialysis 3 times a week. She couldn't attend college, but she wanted to advance herself and took this class and passed it. And for me, the watershed moment, I realized I even have to leave Google to do this, was that these people needed me more. One of them needed me more than my Stanford students. I love Stanford. I adore Stanford. But my Stanford students are incredibly well selected. I can certainly make them a little bit better. But if I can help a soldier in the battlefield to have a life after theater, then I have done so much bigger a deal than teaching at Stanford.
Sebastian, you are a positive populist, because there's nothing, I think, that captures the idea better than what you've just said, which is that everybody should be able to have the same opportunities that the rich and powerful and well-connected have. What's interesting is, you know, I talk about that a lot through, you know, I think about policy and what government can do and so on. You've done it through technology and through business, as being an entrepreneur.
I mean, I see what you've been doing in your technology life and in your professional career. When you look at these things and peel back like what we tend to take for given and ask, are we doing the right thing? You arrive at the belief that in America we have the best universities, there's no question, like Harvard and Yale and Stanford, but they're extremely exclusive. In fact, they thrive on exclusivity. Mm. If you wanted to design a university system, you should almost do the opposite. You should say, let's be inclusive. Like, what if Stanford taught 100 million people? What if MIT taught 100 million people? Mm. So my goal had become almost the opposite. The company Udacity teaches now lots and lots. I think we have just our 50,000th graduate, lots of students here in the heartland. But we have a huge presence, for example, in the Middle East. We have an initiative with the UAE to teach 1 million young people in the Arab-speaking world how to code and how to get a job in coding.
Right.
And that is doable now with technology. Like, in today's day and age, whether I have a million students or a 10 student is about the same amount of work on my end. Whereas in the past, I could never fit 160,000 students into one classroom.
It's an amazing story. I love it. I just want to wrap it up. We've got to stop now, unfortunately. But just thinking about all of the various bits of technology that you have worked on and you're working on, what is it? Is there one you'd pick out, or one feature of them that you'd pick out that makes you positive and feel positive about the future and the progress it's going to bring about for people?
Look, I'm kind of a pessimistic guy. Sometimes I go around the world and I take offense on so many things. Like, why do people die of cancer today? Right? And we put a lot of work into this, but I asked the question, are we doing the right work? I worked, for example, on skin cancer, where we found that an AI-powered iPhone can detect skin cancer with the same accuracy as the best board-certified Stanford-level dermatologist. And for me, technology is just a tool. It's like a shovel or a knife. And for me, the question is, can we leverage these new tools that exist today, that didn't exist yesterday, to the betterment of humanity? And there's so much opportunity. There's an educational opportunity. There's a transportation opportunity. There's an aging. There's a medical opportunity. Say your house was smart enough that every single time you slept, we could check you for congestive heart failure. You looked into your vanity mirror, you could find upcoming strokes. We could listen to you to find Alzheimer earlier. Your phone could do this for you. Every time you touch the steering wheel, you get a 6-point EKG. These are all existing technologies today, right, that we could build today to save human lives.
Well, I think that we're going to hear a lot more about the various technologies you're building in the future, because there's a lot going on. Sebastian, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Steve, it was a total pleasure.
To talk, you know, like in a way, as we've known each other for years, and actually I learned new things and got even more excited about what you're doing and the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.